Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard.
Author William Peter Blatty once won $10,000 on Groucho Marx's game show, You Bet Your Life. When Groucho asked him what he wanted to do with the money, he said, "I'm just going to take some time off and write a novel, no big deal." Well, that novel turned out to be The Exorcist. And in a weird twist of fate, years later, when they were filming The Exorcist, William Peter Blatty thought the atmosphere on the set could use a little levity. So he arranged for Groucho Marx to be dressed as Father Merritt. He would enter the house during one of the shots, take off his hat, and reveal himself. Groucho was all up for doing it, but the director William Friedkin got sick that day, and the whole thing was scrapped. Is that not the spookiest legend or myth you've ever heard about the film The Exorcist? Ha, I didn't think so. Well, they're just going to get spookier from here. My name's Matt Gourley. This is I Was There Too. It's the show where I talk to people present in the great scenes of cinema history. My guest today is Eileen Dietz. She played the face of the demon Pazuzu that you see flashed up on the screen. She also played Reagan during the famous crucifixion, hey, nani, nani, don't talk about that scene, as well as the puking pea-green soup scene and slapping Ellen Burstyn scene, among many others. The Exorcist is probably the most famous horror movie of all time, and it deals with the implications surrounding demon possession. Though if you watch the film carefully, Reagan steals a cookie from the cookie jar early on, and I think that's the reason for all of this happening. The ultimate sin of stealing a cookie. The demon Eileen Dietz plays is called Pazuzu, but it's also known as Captain Howdy, and she can settle the argument of which is the proper name and why they're called what they're called. It was really fun to talk to Eileen, and sometimes a little harrowing because she would actually get a smile that was very similar to the demon Pazuzu that you've seen in the movie. And I'm not going to lie, it freaked me out a little bit. Now let's connect this episode's guest with last episode's. This one came to me in a flash, and it's easy. Paul Rust to Brad Pitt in Inglourious Basterds. Brad Pitt to Harrison Ford in, like, The Devil's Game, some Irish Republican Army drama that came out in the 90s, I think. To Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, with Max von Sydow. Max von Sydow to Eileen Dietz in The Exorcist. This was a fascinating interview, and Eileen Dietz's story arc is very interesting, all of which you can read about in her book, Exorcising My Demons. We talk a little bit about that at the end of the show. So enjoy hearing what it was like to puke pea-green soup on a subarctic set, the director slapping people and firing guns into the air, and eventually and allegedly luring her to a meeting in Hollywood where he told her she'll never work again. Here we go.
The film, The Exorcist, the year 1973, The Role, The Demon Pazuzu, or Captain Howdy, plus a bunch of the other ungodly stuff that Regan did when she was possessed. The actor, Eileen Dietz.
Eileen Dietz, you need to settle a bet for the public because you're the expert. Do you consider the role you played in The Exorcist to be the demon Pazuzu or Captain Howdy? I know it's both, but what's the definitive role?
Well... it depends on, they're almost two different parts.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
Captain Howdy is the face that jumps out at you. In the original, it was only used once, but now they, I think the last one is three times.
At least, yeah. At I least. Watched that one. There's quite a few. Yeah. You get a lot more screen time face-wise
I know.
In that one.
And there's a lot of debate over which, how people like it the best.
Do you have a preference?
Well, the reason I liked it the first time was because when people saw it the first time, there was, of course, no DVDs and yeah. God knows, and there was no VCRs. So when people saw it, when it opened, apparently they'd walk out of the theater and they'd go, did you see that face? And what face? The face that was over Father Karras' mother. No, I didn't see that. And then they go see it again. So that was kind of neat. And then once VCRs came out, they tried to stop it, but it was really hard on the VCR. And now that the DVRs came out, they can stop it.
I did that very thing when I was watching for this film. And because I remember when I first saw it, it feels like it's almost a still shot. But whatever version I watched, the extended version, there's a scene where you're kind of almost like pursing your lips back a little bit. And it gives you a few frames of the demon face moving. And it's incredibly harrowing.
Oh, yeah. Well, to finish the other thought, and then I'll tell you about this.
Please.
So the other thing that I did, which was really Pazuzu, is as you said, I like to say I was the demon that possessed Reagan as opposed to anything else. And so that was Pazuzu, and I was made up to look like Reagan through the absolute magic of Dick Smith, who passed last year.
Yeah, we'll
but
talk about him a bit.
It was his idea to be able to make Reagan or the demon as much look as much like a human being as possible so that you didn't just say, oh, yeah, that's not going to happen to my kid. But anyway, so having done the vomiting sequence, the levitation, the abuse of the cross, as we call it.
that's a very, and, you know what, that's better than what I have in my notes, so let's go with that.
Okay. Yeah. And the death scene at the end and all that, that was really Pazuzu. So that's
okay.
What the difference of it really is. And at least that's how I look at it.
Okay, so let's break down exactly what you were. Obviously, you were the face of Captain Howdy. And then when you are the demon in Reagan's body, you're Pazuzu. So that included the vomiting, right? Which we can talk about in detail. I understand the prosthetics on that were quite an ordeal.
Yeah.
Also, you did the crucifix scene. And anybody that's seen this film knows what we're talking about there. Gets a little hot and bothered.
My assistant has the original crucifix.
What?
She bought it on auction. And when she does shows with me, which you can take a picture with the real crucifix.
She just tracked it down?
She tracked it down. She was the most avid Exorcist fan you could find.
Is that how she found her way to be your assistant?
Well, she used to have this kind of love affair with Linda Blair.
Oh.
And she kind of bought stuff for her. And then Linda just turned her off at a show, which Linda does do sometimes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just kind of almost ignored her. So then, yeah, she decided, my joke with Marianne is that she stalked me, you know, because she decided she had to know me. And we went to a show called Monster Mania in New Jersey. And she came and said hello. And before I knew it, she was sitting next to me. And taking money, which is always nice to have somebody take the money for you because then you don't feel like a salesperson.
This is when people are getting your autograph
yeah.
and that sort of thing. Okay.
And then time went on and I said, I'm doing a show in Ohio. Do you want to come? And she said, yes. And then she did like 20 shows with me. And the expression that we coined was, suddenly you're on the other side of the table, you know, because she had dinner with George Romero.
Oh, wow.
And these are all my manager's clients, but she had dinner with George Romero, with Malcolm McDowell and Adrian Barbeau, Dee Wallace, and all these people that she had just always seen from kind of afar. And she's very funny because she has a really strong New York accent. You know, she's like, Eileen, I can't believe that all this is really happening to me. But anyway, so.
I love that she goes from trying to get with Linda Blair to eventually working for Linda Blair's dark, possessed side.
I know. Well, she actually, at one point, she wanted Linda to sign the crucifix, and Linda didn't want to do it. So all of a sudden, you know, I don't know how Linda feels about that.
So what else were you? Were you a portion where Regan slaps Ellen Burstyn as well?
Yes.
Okay. So is that everything? We covered everything that you did?
Probably not.
Yeah, it sounds like
I
you
also,
did quite a bit.
I was on the film for almost 4 months.
How did you go from initially being the face of Captain Howdy to ending up on set?
totally the other way around. The face for Captain Howdy, we shot the last day of the last shoot, of the last thing. And it was just an idea that makeup had from a makeup test or something like that. And they said, let's shoot it. And one of my funny stories, without going into great detail, is everybody, when is this film going to end? Because they shot it from 14 months, from pre-production to post. And a lot of times nobody was working. We'd be on this really high-paying unemployment while they did the set totally over again when they reshot everything. So I had booked a commercial because I thought we were going to be done.
Oh, during the shoot.
Yeah, we said like this. Last day, or you know, they kept telling me we were going to be done. And you know, the short story is the commercial people, I said, I can't do it, I got to go work on my film. And they said, if you don't do it, we'll call the Screen Actors Guild. You committed to this. And I don't know where my agents were. And so I spoke to the people at The Exorcist, and their famous line was, this is The Exorcist, and we'll report you to the Screen Actors Guild. And all of a sudden, I'm going,
oh my God,
oh my God. So I called the commercial people. I said, how many spots are you doing? And they said, four. I said, if I get there by lunchtime, can we make this work? And he said, yes. And so that was the last shot we did. And the crew, who kind of, they didn't particularly like Billy Freakin' anyway, but they just set up as slow as they could. They knew what was going up. So we did six or seven shots in the morning. They threw me into makeup, washed my hair, took the makeup off, put me in a limo, and took me to the commercial. And the commercial ran for like 3 or 4 years.
What was the commercial for?
It was just a little bank in the South. And I don't remember even the name of it, but it was like, ding, ding, you know, come to so-and-so bank or something.
But so let's go back and talk about how you got started with this film. How did you end up?
I was a New York actress, mm-hmm. and I was running around doing things. I did a couple soap operas other than General Hospital that are all defunct. It makes me old.
Do you remember the names?
Yeah, well, the first one I ever did, I had one line on, and it was called The Doctors. One line is much harder to do than a speech or a paragraph.
Why is that?
Because you keep rehearsing in one line, whatever
it
was.
You give it too much attention?
How are you feeling? How are you feeling? How did it? But then I did Love of Life. I did a PBS special with Sam Waterston. Mm. And so I'd worked a lot. Not a lot, but a lot.
Enough.
Never enough. But so I did a play called Ontological Proof of My Existence, wow. which is a play by Joyce Carol Oates, except it wasn't a play. It was actually a preamble to one of her books. And we did this at a little theater called the Cabiculo. And one fateful night, in New York, you could go from agent to agent. You didn't just have to sign with one person. And they called me the next day, and they said they actually had a real casting breakdown for this part of somebody who was small and who was strong and who could act. And they said, do you want to do this? And I said, sure. Which people delight in calling me a double or a stunt double or all that stuff. Well, doubles don't have breakdowns, right? I was thinking the other day, if it had been a double, which is an extra, I never would have done it. And my whole life would have been totally different because I don't do extra work. So then after that, I went down there. I met the casting director. She said, go home, read the book, and then come back and do some improvisations for me. And that's another fun part in the book because, I mean, how do you play a demon?
Yeah, you tell me. So when you went back and did the improvisations, was it just for the casting director or was for
No, just for the casting
okay,
director.
Okay, so what were the improvisations? What did you
do? Well, I decided the closest I could come to a demon was a wild animal. It's like, you know.
It's pretty
so
good.
So I went to the library, got a book about wild animals. And I make up my own method of acting.
Yeah.
Made my apartment very dark, lit some candles, and did wild animals.
Were you thinking of a specific wild animal, or which one do you think got you the role?
I think it was a combination of like a leopard and a tiger. Which anyone that would go, I mean, this is radio. Anyone that would go, which is also like a cat.
I do have to tell you, this is eerie seeing you flash up on screen as the face of Captain Howdy and then the face you just made right now. Yeah. It is a little chilling.
Oh, good. Yeah, we like to do that at shows. But that's really how it happened. And then after that, the improvs, then she said, I'd like you to meet some people. And That's when I met Billy Friedkin and Linda Blair and her mother and Dick Smith, which was the important one.
Yeah.
And then I went up to Dick Smith's studio so that they could make a face mask to see if they could fit the same mask.
So you're already cast at this point.
Face. Oh, yeah, it was great. I love it.
What was your first meeting with William Friedkin like before we get to the makeup?
It was just very perfunctory.
Uh-huh.
Hi, how are you? Fine. That was basically the whole relationship we had during the shoot.
Okay.
You know, it was very perfunctory.
Okay.
And Billy Friedkin really kind of lived in his own world. Yeah. I don't think he was much of an actor's director to anybody.
Didn't seem like it. I mean, the stories are famous from the set of him slapping the guy that played Father Dyer to make him react accordingly in the scene. So did you ever witness any of that kind of intense direction from him?
Well, the best I did during the slapping scene, he decided he'd shoot off a gun.
So you were there? Because I've
that
heard
was me.
That. Oh, my God.
And so the first time they shot off the gun, it was kind of, oh, my. Yeah, everybody reacted the way they were supposed to, except me, of course.
Did he just shoot it right as you slapped?
No, it was right before. It was on their entrance.
Okay.
So the entrance, watch what's going on, take a second slap. So the first time it was great, I guess. You know, the gun went off. The second time it was like, you know, you kind of startled. The third time it's kind of like, what the hell was that? You know, who cares? And, you know, it's just about trusting the actors. There was another time that I wasn't on the set that he decided the stench of the demon should be really bad. So he mixed up a whole thing of rotten eggs and rotten meat and rotten stuff like that. And the crew just got sick and they had to stop shooting that day. It's kind of fun because I'm the only one really on the set of the movie that can tell you stories like that, because Linda was either too young or doesn't care to remember, which is a lot. She has a love-hate with The Exorcist.
I'm sure.
And Ellen Burstyn doesn't care about any of that stuff. And unfortunately, you know, Jason Miller's dead,
yeah.
You know, and Max von Sydow has grown into his makeup, you know.
I know. It's incredible that he's 44 when that movie was made.
And now he's 80-something.
Yeah.
Because that movie, the anniversary, was just a year and a half ago.
That's right.
No, 2 years ago. We're going into March.
Yeah. This movie came out the year I was born.
Oh, shit.
You just made a Captain Howdy face.
It's just like, okay, that's good.
I'm not going to say what year this movie
came
out.
And here I was acting. And most people that know The Exorcist probably know when it came out.
Yeah.
It seems impossible that it was that long ago.
Really?
It doesn't seem like yesterday, but it certainly seems like a couple of years ago. It certainly doesn't seem that long ago. But
were you aware on set that you guys were making something seminal, or was
not
it
at all?
Not at all. So
not at all.
Just another
job. We were just
job,
making
huh?
a horror film. It was the biggest project. My first movie was an epic called Teenage Gang Debs. They fight. They love. And it was all about knives.
Teenage Gang Debs?
Uh huh.
I've got to go straight home and find
out.
Oh,
they have that. It's they have that somewhere. I have it.
I'm going to buy up every copy.
I fell in love with a guy named Piggy. It was a great, actually that one though was, you know, it was at a time of drive-ins and they were all over, particularly in the South, I guess. And it was black and white with, I was told, a very pulsating, you know, beat. And it was very successful on that circuit.
Uh-huh.
And one night my husband was watching television and the next morning he said, Eileen, did you do a movie in white go-go boots? You know, and I said, yeah. He said, well, it was on, gosh, I forget. Now I can't remember the name of the show. And I can't remember the actress who did it. But it was on, and that's why I got the copy of it. And they showed a clip of all the movies in the whole world they could have shown. They showed that clip.
Oh, my God.
And so we ordered the, at the time, it was a tape.
Uh-huh.
And now I have it in DVD just because it's fun.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, let's talk a little bit about Linda.
It was also my first nude scene.
What, Teenage Debs?
Oh, no, that was David Holzman's Diary. My mind just did a flip-flop.
Oh my gosh. Eileen, scandalous.
In the 70s, there was a lot of that going on.
Sure.
And plays and, well, that kind of hair, of
yeah,
course.
That's right. Yeah,
there was a lot of that going on. But it was different than now.
Now, what was it like working with Linda Blair? How much was she aware of the adult level of the material? And
I don't think she was aware of it at all. I think and we spent a lot of time together. When she wasn't going to school, you know, I'd go in there, we'd play cards and we'd play games and stuff like that. And I think it was just an adventure. She was, at that time, and it was in the 70s, if somebody wants to do the math, I know that kids, particularly here, were a lot more innocent than they are now. In fact, I suspect that if they made the movie now, they wouldn't hire me at all. That, you know, people like Ella Fanning.
Yeah.
I mean, they're rather, they have the child part of it, but they're also rather sophisticated. I mean.
I actually found myself thinking while watching this movie that they couldn't quite get away with this today. I mean, the things that she says and does in that movie, I know this was obviously a scandal at the time when it came out. This was headline news. Evangelical groups were trying to shut it down. But I think today it would almost seem harder. I don't know. There's something about being the first one that at least you get through the door.
More difficult to go through
today?
It
or not less. To go through it, but to make a movie like that, to have
a child spewing stuff like that.
Yeah, a 12-year-old girl doing those things. I wonder if you could get away with that today.
I would think you could get more away with it now.
Maybe
people are much more sophisticated about those things.
I want to ask you where they got the name Captain Howdy. That seems so specific to me. It has you have the demon Pazuzu, which sounds like an ancient source
of evil.
It's
a fallen angel. I believe Pazuzu is a fallen angel.
Okay, so that sounds epic and almost biblical. Captain Howdy has the same kind of, I don't know, terror associated with it because it feels more like a kid's show. Well, I mean, even the Howdy Doody name association. Tell us where the name Captain Howdy came from.
Well, actually, I think Captain Howdy was actually a pilot name back in World War II. But that has nothing to do with The Exorcist. But I think there is a Captain Howdy.
I know there's Captain Cody from the serials, like the old war serials. She's playing with a Ouija board, and Ellen Burstyn's character says, "Who are you talking to?" And she just tosses off, "Oh, Captain Howdy."
Well, so you know.
This is how.
That's how.
Oh, but was that improvised, or was that in the – that's from the book, or am I wrong about that?
Do you know I have a script, and I'm going to go home and look at it?
Okay. Maybe we can post it on the website after.
There's somebody – a friend of mine has a charity, actually, and he asked me if I would do, 500 pictures for him, but include quotes. Uh-huh. And you put these really long quotes, you know, it's an excellent day for an exorcism. That takes too long. And I told him I'd go through the script and see if I could find any three-word quotes. So while I'm doing that, I will absolutely see if it's in the original script or it was improvised, because I do have the original script at home.
Let's talk just a little bit about Max von Sydow. Now, I've read a story when Linda Blair had to say some of the horrible things she had to say. He blew his line the first time because he was so taken aback by it. Was he a gentleman, or is that even true?
He was very much a gentleman. And the thing was that I think he didn't understand that, talking about Billy Friedkin directing actors again, that he didn't understand the Southern Baptist feel to this thing, that kind of religion and thing, because he was Swedish. Mm-hmm. And Billy would go up to him and say, "We need this kind of fervor." Da, 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 da. And so they actually took a lot of lines away from him. But he was so nice because, you know, there I was all tucked up in the bed freezing. And they weren't cold because they had wetsuits underneath their clothes. And, you know, most people know the set was kept to about 5 degrees. And it was cold. It was cold.
Seems like it.
And they decided if people ate, they would stay warmer. So they set up a little hot dog stand, soup stand right outside.
No, not soup, because pea soup is the famous
thing. I know.
Did they serve pea soup?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't even remember if there was soup. It seems like there was, but they had hamburgers and hot dogs. Everybody on the, 14 months, well, it wasn't, the shooting wasn't 14, was just getting fatter and fatter. And I don't know if they were warmer and warmer, but they got fatter and fatter.
A little more insulation.
Yeah.
And how was Ellen Burstyn?
I didn't really know her very well.
But you got to slap her.
Yeah, I did. That was fun. and I did most of the off-camera work for her. Uh-huh. People know that when they're shooting, if you have two people in a scene or three, four, or five people, but specifically if they have two people in a scene, when the other actor is doing their lines and the camera's only on them, somebody has to feed them the lines and hopefully they know what they're doing. I was doing a movie with John Savage and it was my turn to do this rather heavy scene. And I said, "Where's John?" They say, "He's taking a nap." I said, "What do you mean he's taking a nap?" Anyway.
Well, that is kind of the dividing line between actors, is there are actors who will do their own coverage and there are actors who won't.
So I did most of the off-camera work for Linda that Ellen could react to.
Interesting.
But we didn't really know each other very well, and she naturally was very, very protective over Linda. It was almost like a mother-child
thing
that was going on. I don't know if they've kept up the relationship or what's happened, but I know at that time. But otherwise, Ellen pretty much kept to herself, and she had a headset. And on the scenes I was in, she had a headset on. She'd listen to music to get her in the mood. Actually, I don't know anybody from the movie anymore except Bill Blatty.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he found me on Facebook. So then he sent me an autographed copy of The Exorcist, and I sent him a joke about writers, and, you know, we corresponded back and forth.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break for a commercial, and then we'll come right back with Eileen Dietz. Back with Eileen Dietz. So let's talk about your process with all the prosthetics. Particularly the puking apparatus was pretty intense, right? Tell us about that.
It was like a horse's bit. It literally went across your mouth, like if people can imagine a horse's bit, with very, very small tubes that I can't help showing you. Like small tubes that went underneath the prosthetics. And
so the prosthetic is on your cheek.
That's, and for you guys who don't know what prosthetics are, and I guess there are still people who don't, they're little pieces of manufactured kind of like almost a little fabric, almost like a maybe a big Band-Aid except soft, something like that. And when they put makeup on your face so it doesn't look like a mask, they do it piece by piece by piece, which is why The Exorcist took 3.5 hours to put the makeup on every day. And about 1.5 hours to take it off, which is kind of rough because you want to go home.
Yeah.
So the prosthetics, the tubes had to be so thin that the prosthetics would cover the tube, and so you wouldn't see it was a tube, you know, naturally coming out. And you couldn't talk, you couldn't eat, and you couldn't smoke. And that pretty much covered it. You know, it was like, but hey, I was young. It was a, you know, a major motion picture, and Max van Sydow was there. And I knew Max because my mother had taken us to see foreign films. So I knew who he was. Yeah. And it was like, there was nothing that I could do in that movie that wasn't fine.
How long did you have to wear that horse's bit at one time?
I think, I don't really quite remember that. I'm not sure if it was before lunch or after lunch, but it was a couple hours.
Now, those tubes must have been sort of thick and able to get that thick pea soup out of there, right? They couldn't be tiny, how? Huh?
Well, somehow, maybe. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if they dilated.
Diluted?
Diluted, thank you.
Yeah.
I was thinking of dilate on your eyes, if they diluted it or not. But I know after it went through there, I had to kind of move it around in my mouth and kind of help it. And then they didn't, they actually did enhance the stream, and they had no CGI, so I don't know how they enhanced things, but they enhanced it. And Jason Miller was not pleased.
Really?
Yeah. Father Karras, he didn't know it was coming.
Oh, that's
so
right.
So the reaction, you probably read about that.
I did,
the
yeah.
reaction, it was, yeah.
It was supposed to hit him in the chest, right, too, but it also, it hits him in the face.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, I had a spitting scene that I used to rehearse as well. because I spit like a girl, and I made up all these things, right? Because who knows? And I figured a demon had to spit like a man. So I went home, and I had one of those shades in my New York apartment that you pull down, and I made a bullseye on it.
What?
And I literally used to practice going, you know, instead of, you know, something like that.
Yeah, like so there was proper Loogie Hawking spit, one of those. Do you ever hear of that term? When you hawk a loogie, that's like...
but I can imagine what it means.
Yeah, I won't do it. I'll spare the listeners. But you spend a good amount of time in junior high learning how to properly hawk a loogie.
Where were you from?
I'm from here. I'm from Whittier.
Oh,
far away from
you're
here.
From Law.
I am.
I was born in New York.
Oh, we have the coasts. We've bookended this country.
We certainly do.
So overall, Dick Smith, you must have spent a lot of time with him in the makeup chair.
Dick was, I mean... He passed last summer. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, he didn't pass from like old age or anything. He died from complications of a broken hip, which I guess he was 92. And he's just the sweetest guy in the whole world. And he used to always watch himself putting on the prosthetics in the mirror. So it looked like he was watching himself talk, but he wasn't. And he was a great talker. He told us stories about Marlon Brando and Dustin Hoffman. And I mean, he is the, well, the main thing I remember about Marlon Brando is he couldn't stand making that face mask, being inside the face mask. It made him totally claustrophobic, and they had to take it off.
Which face mask are you talking
about? The one for the Godfather.
Oh, those jowl prosthetics that he had to wear.
All those, you have to make a face mask. I have two at home that are actually bookends from other shows I've done.
Really?
And they're kind of creepy.
That's right. Now, you've kind of done a huge assortment of horror-related roles.
Oh, I've cornered the market on middle-aged.
You're the queen of Scream.
Yeah.
Are you drawn to them, or are they drawn to you both?
It's a combination of both. And I guess I'm typecast, which is fine.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about how, after the film came out, you were not allowed to talk about the fact that you did these roles?
Well, no.
You don't want to talk about it. You'll talk about it. I feel like I already know you.
It was extremely right after it happened, I didn't talk about anything else. It was like people talking about a bad marriage. You'd say, how are you, Eileen? And, you know, I'd spew the whole thing.
Just because it was such an ordeal?
It was horrible. I was invited to come out to California, just I was supposed to talk about the film, and they invited me to come out here. Three agents were going to sign me. I was married at the time. This is a demon face again. And he's the one who convinced me to come out, because I also think in our lives we have something that I call a God nudge, or that thing that's down in your belly that tells you don't do that, don't do that. And we all have it. They call it gut reaction and stuff. We all have it. And everything in my being below my at my waist said, don't go to California. Don't go. If you're going to complain about blah, 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 and they're not recognize you, but don't go to California. And then people told me not to go, and certainly not to go with my ex-husband, but I went anyway. And when I got there, apparently it was life is kind of funny, and there was a woman in my acting class, because everybody in New York knew what I'd done. The breakdown went out. The breakdown meaning the casting notice. Everybody knew. She had a friend who worked for the LA Times, and so she told her friend who worked for the LA Times, and I had signed an agreement that I wouldn't say anything, because they felt it'd be scarier if everybody thought a 12-year-old was doing their own work. And so I said I wouldn't talk about it.
And this includes also the woman that did
Mercedes
the voice.
Mercedes McCambridge,
yes,
yeah.
And the spider walk, though, that was never in the original version.
The spider walk came later.
Yeah. But people were really thinking that she did the voice?
There were six
Linda
people
Blair?
That yeah. did that part.
Okay.
And my contention right now, before I get back to that, the whole thing was about the Oscars, and that's why they created this campaign to say I wasn't in the movie, I never did any work, I just told you about the work I did, that I was just this upstart actress that would do anything for publicity. And, you know, at that age, you have no money, you don't do anything. And then the rumor went around that I was suing them, and of course I wasn't suing them because I didn't have the money to
that
sue
anybody.
That
rumor is still online. That's hilarious.
And so a lot of it was horrendous. Someone came up to me once and said, you can't be Eileen Deese. I said, why not? And they said, oh, she's some bleach blonde floozy that'll do anything to get her name in the paper. Oh. And it was right after Watergate. I was in California. I was on the Warner Brothers lot. You know, I wanted to be an actress since I was seven. And, you know, I was here. I'd made it. I had agents. I was walking down the lot. The sun was out and everything. And I walked into a small bungalow and I sat down and Billy freaking came out of the office. I can still tear up over this. Came out of the office.
I'd like to see Pazuzu cry.
Really? But looked at me and said, you will never work in this town again, and left.
Was that a chance meeting, or did he know?
No, he had set it up. That Warner Brothers called me and asked me to come by. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And I sat there, and like the author said, the sun went away. There was someone behind the clouds. Everything I'd ever dreamed about in my life that, like I said, since I was little, every dream I had, everything I had, just suddenly went out the window when he said, you'll never work again. And I hadn't done anything. I mean, I'd kept my word. I later found out they garnished about $250,000 more money in PR about who did what. And then they came after Mercedes McCambridge, who had won an Oscar for All the King's Men. And she wasn't going to take that, you know.
Yeah.
And, in fact, they ran an article in the New York Times about her, said she was drinking again. That's why. And she'd been sober for 20 years. And that's where she got the voice from. So it was pretty bad. And all three agents, of course, dropped me. They didn't even want to see me.
Because of that
acting? Well, and things were different then. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the 70s, you know, you could probably be a drug abuser. You could do anything you want. But if you messed around just to get your name in the paper, or you were a publicity monger or stuff like that, they didn't want anything to do with you. So they all dropped my
meetings.
So where
did they get the idea that you were breaking your vows
of silence? What I started to say. That, yeah. So the woman that knew the woman that worked for the LA Times was best friends with the gossip columnist at the time, whose name escapes me, but she was the head of Hopper of that moment. Yeah. So she just released one little sentence in her column that there was a girl out here that said she was in The Exorcist. I just never thought I was ever going to work again, because I didn't know what – I actually walked on the 20th Century lot. Because I didn't know you weren't supposed to. Innocence is a great thing sometimes. And I went to see the people with Planet of the Apes, who was a casting director named Morvin Page.
Which you eventually ended up in the television show.
Well, that's what happened. Right. I just walked in his office. I said, hey, I just did this huge makeup job in New York, and I want to be an ape or a chimpanzee. And he said, well, read this. And so I read the scene. And they cast me. And then I went to another place. They did a show called Korg, 70,000 BC. And I did the same thing. I just come off, because they were Neanderthal people. I said, I just came off two big makeup shows, and I want to be on the show. And they read me, and I got the show. And then I started working again. I did Helter Skelter, and that led to General Hospital, and you know, a whole bunch of television, Happy Days, and stuff like that. I finally found a little boutique agency that would handle me. But, yeah, so that's what happened. It was pretty bad. And then my husband and I broke up, thank God. That lasted a year, or just under a year. And then Facebook. Bless Facebook. I get a Facebook message that says, I don't know if you remember me, but I'm your ex-brother-in-law and Richard is dead. And I started singing this line from Chorus Line, which is, I felt nothing. Oh, I felt nothing.
You know, a demon.
I know, but as I've learned more about life and spiritualism and stuff like that, that I could blame him forever because he did talk me into coming out to L.A., but I had to take responsibility for it.
I see. And when were you finally allowed to kind of come out of the closet as the demon Pazuzu?
Come out of the closet?
Legally.
I don't know if it was a question. I don't know if I ever was.
But you've just done it.
I go to the spiritual center, which is science of the mind, not Scientology. and I ran into Dee Wallace. Uh-huh. Who you guys must know.
Well,
she played the mom
in
E.T.,
yeah.
Frighteners, Cujo. And I had known Dee because we lived in the same complex on Larrabee when I first came out here. And Dee was running around, da-da-da, and I said, what are you doing? And she said, I do horror conventions. And I said, what are they? And she said, oh, da-da-da-da-da, and you sign things and stuff like that. And then I had dinner with a friend of mine, and he said, do you know that the picture of Captain Howdy is on the cover of Fangoria magazine and on top of a book? So then I started thinking, and I saw Dee again, and Dee said, do you want me to introduce you to my manager, Chris Rowe? And that's how it all changed. Then I decided, because for a long time, I just didn't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I was so hurt. I mean, I almost even can't express how hurt and devastated I was. And I kept trying to, you know, examine it and see if what was my fault, except coming out. And then they did The Heretic soon after, but because of everything that came down, they wouldn't see me for The Heretic. It was just devastating.
Now, jumping back just briefly, what was your reaction when you saw the film? Because you knew you were just making a horror film, and then you end up in a horror film that changes cinema and that gets nominated for Best Picture. First horror film, only horror film ever to do that?
I know it's the first. They didn't give, as far as I know, the only big horror film winner still is Kathy Bates from Misery.
Oh, yeah.
And probably Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, Silence of the Lambs.
Well, Jodie Foster won an award. I don't know if he did. But horror films at that time just didn't win awards.
Right. What was your reaction to the film when you saw it, though? It must have been
Believe it or not, and maybe I didn't have the pulse of everybody. We all went to a screening on Third Avenue in New York. And I swear the biggest jump was at the very beginning with the rats in the attic. And a lot of that just grew. Nobody knew. it's still, after we saw the screening, nobody really knew what would happen. And Warner Brothers was really smart. I think it was the first film that they didn't let people into the movies until the other one got out, so that they could show the lines and people throwing up, you know, and screaming from the things. And they just really created, which was not to say that the film wasn't a very, very good film, but they also created an atmosphere for the film. They were very smart. And the set was closed during the whole shooting. In fact, you weren't allowed to take pictures out. I have two pictures that I took with my camera. I have no idea how I got them, how I saved them. But even Dick Smith wasn't allowed to take pictures.
Do you still have those pictures?
I have two.
Are they online? Can you?
I believe they're on my webpage.
So finally, why don't you tell us a bit about your book, Exorcising My Demons?
The whole first part of it is truly about how this little skinny little kind of flat-chested buck-toothed kid from Queens got to be in the scariest movie of all time when, you know, I was coming out of the era of Jane Mansfield and Marilyn Monroe, and people just used to laugh at me and say, you can't be an actress. What makes you think you can be an actress? And so it's about dreams and choices and that God nudge, and whatever your dream is, don't give it up. But that's what it's about. And then I get to the whole part about doing the play and the audition and things I did to get ready for the part that I haven't talked about, and meeting Billy Friedkin and Linda Blair, going to Dick Smith's studio and what that's all about, the first day on the set. And then the end is an epilogue. I would just add to it through whatever reason, besides the question you didn't ask, the other third most question that people ask.
Well, you were saying this at the break, that I have not asked two questions that people always ask you that you get tired of a little bit. Is that right?
What about all those scary things that happened on the set?
Oh, the curse? Come on.
Yeah. So, you know, it depends who the person is. Sometimes they want to hear, yes, it was scary.
Well, because two actors died before the movie was over.
Yeah, but it was 14 and a half months.
There's a statistical chance people are going to die. One of whom was an aged actress, we'll say. You know, yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibility that she could pass on. The one that plays Father Karras's mother.
Oh, yeah. 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 She was nice. Like you said, she was really old anyway. And the second one was I scared.
Were you scared?
No, because I was on the other side of the camera.
Asked and answered.
Hey, they're paying me, yeah.
Where can people find your book?
Aha. Then we come back there. If you get in touch with me on Facebook, which is just under Eileen Dietz, and say you want the book, I'll give you an address that you could send a check or a money order to, and I'll mail it back. I just mail the book. And the reason that's nice is because you can get it autographed that way.
Oh, is mine autographed?
Not yet.
Will you? Do me the pleasure.
I will do that.
Okay, Eileen, thank you so much for coming in today and talking about
this. Okay, but wait, I'm not going to let you go yet. The other thing
so
you can
close.
Do is go to my webpage, which is www.eileendietz.com.
Yes.
The shop is up there, too, and you can order Pazuzu statues.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How do you have those?
Statues.
What's really going on here?
I don't believe in coincidence. I don't believe in anything. I just believe in miracles, and I think we have little miracles every day, like you got my book.
That's my little miracle.
That's your little miracle.
We've got God nudges and little miracles.
Yeah, so you could go on there in my shop and see what you'd like to buy, and I think Pazuzu's good luck.
It was good luck for you.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Eileen. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it was my pleasure talking.
Bye. And now it's time for a variety pack edition of
Damn, I Wasn't There Too.
This is the segment where I talk about people that were originally considered or cast in roles from the film in question. But today, we're not even just limiting ourselves to actors. We're going to talk directors and composers. Just get ready. First up, the role of Regan. What would have been an earlier start to her teen scream queen dominance, not easy to say, Jamie Lee Curtis was sought to play the part of Regan. But apparently her mother, former scream queen supreme, rolls off the tongue, Janet Lee refused. Speaking of mothers and daughters, according to Variety magazine, Carrie Fisher and her mother Debbie Reynolds were also sought after to play the part of Regan and Chris McNeil. There's not even a teen scream queen in there, and I can't get it out. But speaking of magazines, it was reported in Panorama magazine that William Friedkin was considering Brooke Shields for the part of Regan, but ultimately decided against it because she was too young for the part. Even Dana Plato, who played Arnold's older sister Kimberly on Different Strokes, said she was up for the role. but in a book called Former Child Stars, The Story of America's Least Wanted. The author of The Exorcist, William Peter Blatty, later said that he had no such recollection of this actually happening, and that Plato herself may have made it up. Can you just feel the legend giving you chills? Next up, Reagan's mother, Chris McNeil. Audrey Hepburn was William Friedkin's first choice to play the role, and Warner Brothers was all behind this because of her good critical commercial reputation. But she only agreed to do it if it would be filmed in Rome, and it wasn't. Teen screen queen debut. Teen screen queen. Shirley MacLaine, Jill Clayburgh, and Geraldine Page were also reportedly approached or considered, and Anne Bancroft was another choice, but she was in her first month of pregnancy and was dropped. Jane Fonda was offered the role of Chris as well, but she declined to do it, telling William Peter Blatty she didn't believe in fairy tales. Jane Fonda, from Barbarella and Newsroom. Next, Father Karras. Considerations included Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino, and Gene Hackman. Stacy Keach was given the role, but after William Friedkin saw Jason Miller in a Broadway play, he gave Jason Miller the role, and Warner Brothers had to buy Stacy Keach out of his contract. The studio also wanted Marlon Brando for the role of Father Marin. William Friedkin immediately vetoed this, stating that with Brando in the film, it would just become a Brando movie. Now let's talk directors. Stanley Kubrick originally wanted to direct the film, but only if he could produce it himself. The studio was worried that he would go over budget and over schedule, I can't imagine. So they eventually settled on Mark Rydell, but William Peter Blatty himself insisted that William Friedkin direct. After a standoff with the studio, which initially refused to budge over Rydell, Blatty eventually got his way. John Borman had been offered the chance to direct, but he declined because he felt the storyline was too cruel towards children. However, he did accept the role to direct the sequel, Exorcist II, The Heretic. Other directors that Warner had approached included Arthur Penn, Peter Bogdanovich, and Mike Nichols, who didn't want to shoot a film so dependent on a child's performance. And finally, composer. Lalo Schifrin composed a score for The Exorcist, but it was rejected. Friedkin reportedly actually hated the music so much that he stopped the orchestra when they were playing, removed the reels that had been recording, and promptly threw them into the streets in front of Lalo and his wife. Teen Screen Queen debut. Anyway, I made it through. That's all for...
Damn, I wasn't there too.
Well, was The Exorcist cursed? I don't know, but my speech was on this episode. I would like to thank Molly Hockey for getting me in touch with Eileen Dietz. And remember, if you know of a way to connect me to someone that was present in a great scene in cinema history, email me at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. And please, if you can, give this podcast a review on iTunes. The more 5-star reviews, the better the news.
Pop.
Pop?
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.